You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for March 20th, 2015. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside Ted Cruz's Worldwide Conflagration Preschool, it's the Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Don't take your four-year-old to a Ted Cruz speech.
Because there's circuses closer to your town with less scarier clowns than Ted Cruz. And if you don't want to traumatize a four-year-old, having a lunatic right-wing senator who's going to run for president one of these days tell them that your world is literally on fire is not the way to go.
And the fascinating part of that is when she started to cry, he couldn't tell her he was being figurative because he was really trying to terrify the seniors in that room. He couldn't walk it back. And
he's trying to make at least 70 other people fill their diapers.
Yeah.
So you can't just take time out to comfort one of them just because four. You know, there's a lot of old people here I need to scare the crap out of. So yeah. I'm sorry, kid, but, you know, you're just them's are the breaks. If you didn't want to play hardball with me, you shouldn't have come to the rally.
Really?
And that's just the second half of that, I think, is just good rule of thumb. Just don't go to political rallies with Ted Cruz. It's scary. And unless you're there for, amusement purposes, in which case, go knock yourself out. It's fun freak show.
I just don't see any of them as serious. I can't take any of them seriously. And it upsets me so much when I see people in the news media seriously looking at polls regarding the Republican candidates. It's just I know that's horse racing is their job. Yep.
Yeah. Well, the new MSNBC business plan is keep Morning Joe.
Yeah.
Because that's just gold. That's just that's the goose that lays something. The goose that lays the golden egg. Give a 3-hour block on liberal television to a right wing hack and his little sock puppet and bring out every centrist Wall Street right-wing troll in the universe and give them a free platform. That's how you start your day on liberal MSNBC.
And don't forget, no labels. No labels people get to come on, too.
Well, yeah, that would be your Harold Ford Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, for every Republican atrocity, there has to be a centrist right there at the elbow reciting the magical words, but it's both sides. It's both. Go back to sleep. You didn't see anything. Ted Cruz didn't make a baby cry. No. Both sides. That Harry Reid probably made a baby cry too at some point. And that's how they get away with it. It's a crime. It's a crime committed in front of everyone. But apparently the new MSNBC business plan is just sack everyone who is not related to Rachel Maddow.
Yeah.
Non-Rachel Maddow. Everyone is on the chopping block potentially to go, which is a tragedy. But what you gonna do? That's the way we play now. If I might point out, there is a parallel. I don't know if you want to talk about this now or jump ahead a little bit. There's a parallel between this and Bill O'Reilly.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute because everyone wants us to talk about Aaron Schock.
Oh, yes. Let's get right into the Schock treatment.
Everyone has been emailing us and saying, this is your congressman, right? Well, no. Aaron Schock is our next-door neighbor's congressman, and his office is downtown about 15 blocks from our house. So
in this city, in Springfield, it's this weird yin-yang.
One district is drawn specifically for Republicans to win, and the other is drawn so that it's competitive.
Right. But the way it's sort of two hands, they're sort of curled around each other in the middle.
Yeah.
So there's this little section where you're like two blocks apart.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can travel 70 miles and be in one district and 70 miles be in another. But there's this one little area in downtown Springfield, which is essentially a spiral.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on the other side of the double yellow line, so he's not our congressman. But we love him anyway because he's so awesome.
He's so pretty.
He's so pretty. He's such a pretty man.
And he resigned this week.
He did.
The people that I've spoken to, the locals that I've spoken to, all have said, well, you know, he got too big for his britches.
Yeah. And he wore them fancy pastel pants, you know.
He wasn't wearing the overalls like the farm people told him to. Yeah, and I will say that this area, first of all, has a lot of seniors in it.
Uh-huh.
And wouldn't you say that probably 80% of the seniors that we know grew up on a farm less than 100 miles from here?
Oh, yes. Or married into that.
And I'm not making fun of that. That is the backbone of America.
And the people we know, some of them are real serious hardcore liberals, too. But they have a very, very rural, small town ethos. That's their vision of normal America.
And Instagram is not a part of that.
No. Overalls. Going shopping at Big R for... Yeah. You want to get a cherry
pitter? Big R's is the farm store where you go and get a cherry pitter machine and a pair of pants.
And a shotgun.
And a shotgun.
And a tractor if you need one. Yeah. And you know what? It's a great store. I really love it.
You like it because they have pants long enough for your legs. Yeah. Yeah.
But the point being, that's where we live.
And a fancy man is not...
No.
Representative of this community. So
let me explain. Dick Durbin lives around here.
Think about Dick Durbin.
Dick Durbin does
Senator
not show
Dick
up
Durbin.
In pastel pants and wrap around aviator sunglasses. He doesn't comment on your shoes. He doesn't look, and this is something I heard on the radio the other day on local radio.
Mm-hmm.
They were hanging out with having a conversation with Aaron Schock, and he was saying he recognized my Dolce & Gabbana shades and commented on how awesome they were. And he said, look, no straight man in the world is going to A, recognize the brand you're wearing, and B, comment on how awesome they are. But none of that would have mattered because Dick Durbin is a powerful man. Dick Durbin is the number two man in the Senate.
Right. He has the Senate.
He has the ear of Barack Obama. He is a truly powerful individual. And when he comes to Springfield and hangs out, and believe me, he hangs out.
He comes to art events and music in the park. And you will see him in Springfield shaking hands and
calling up on the radio, chatting with him. He knows exactly where he comes from.
Absolutely.
And he dresses,
remember his campaign ad, picking up a farmer on the side of the road to give him a ride into town in his pickup truck? Yep.
The part about dress for the job you want, not the job you have. Mm-hmm. Dick Durbin has the job he wants.
Exactly. He is not trying to run for president. Absolutely
and he's
not.
He's bland and boring and a farm.
Slightly grumpy. Occasionally, it doesn't have a lot of tolerance for far left.
No,
I wouldn't call him a liberal.
No, but he's like a pharmacist with heartburn.
Yeah.
He's just kind of, he's the guy behind you at the post office and nondescript and complete. Now, Aaron Schock wants to be a rock star.
He's a playboy. He is a closeted gay Republican playboy. Yeah.
And he dresses the part. And there's the problem. He dresses the part and he acts the part. He forgets that he has to keep coming home to the district where they liked him.
Yeah.
They liked the idea that they were sending a guy to Washington that he was,
TV. Yeah.
He looked great on TV. And they saw their boy on Fox every other goddamn week. And they liked what he said, and he was the rising star of the GOP, but he just couldn't keep his shit together. He could not be
both.
Got too
big for his britches is what he did.
Yeah. Well, he couldn't be both the gay playboy of the Western world and a congressman from a rural district.
Represent corn and agriculture. Yeah.
He couldn't do it. He couldn't do it.
The soybean, there's the soybeans and the corn.
And then
your dad comes out and announces.
Oh, God. And his dad, again, his dad could very well be Dick Durbin. Is that kind of like, you know this guy.
And this is definitely a case where Aaron Schock's staff should have handed Aaron Schock's dad one 3x5 card to read.
remember that scene in Iron Man where, Agent, what's his name, hands him the cards. Stick to the cards.
Stick to speech. Just read the cards.
Oh, this is really good. Yeah. No, we've done this before. This is where your staff comes in, even if you're resigning, because, staff is suddenly not going to go to any more Katy Perry concerts.
Yeah.
They're going to have a boring life. They're not going to have the wild, fancy life that Aaron Schock staffer has. But, Your staff goes to your dad, who they have to know. I mean, your staff has to know your family. They're in your life. And sit him down and say, you know, we know you love your son. We know you support your son. And we know you want to do best for him. So what we're suggesting is here, you take this card, you go out, there's cameras outside. All you say is, I love my son. I support him in whatever he does. I know he'll turn out great. I know everything will be fine. He's an honest and wonderful man and a great public servant.
He has our 100% support. The end.
Boom, done. Go back in. So, no questions. Thank you very much. I want to sit, you know, I'm going to church. Whatever you want to say after that is fine. If you're going to Olive Garden, that's great. that's a little more downscale.
I'm going to Big R's. I got to go get some pants.
I'm going to Big R's. These pants, they wear like iron, you know. But after 10 years, got to go
get a new pair. Yeah.
The belt loop
gets a little loose, you know. It gets a little loose after 10 years, yeah.
You know, these ain't real rivets they're using here. These are them plastic rivets, and they'll pop after a while.
But Dad announced that he was totally not gay would be successful. And in 2 years, he'll be a total success again if he doesn't go to jail.
Yeah. And by the way, did I mention he's not gay? just wanted to get real clear about that. So we're clear. Son, he's a fancy dresser, doesn't like women, apparently, travels around with men a lot, but he's totally not gay. So let's check that off the list and move on to the part where he's not going to go to jail. Unless he goes to jail.
Yeah. And if he doesn't go to jail, he will be successful.
Yeah. And I have no idea. I didn't remember this until I looked it up. Do you know who the U.S. attorney was on the Dan Rostenkowski case?
No.
He wanted to become Eric Holder.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is just another Illinois politician. We have lots of Illinois politicians who go to jail. OK, yeah. We're like really good at this.
Joy Reid brought this up this week. I thought this was telling about Jesse Jackson Jr.
Yeah, it's not apples and apples that we're comparing here.
We need to be fair. Jesse Jackson Jr. falsified
the third. Jesse Jackson the third
falsified records. To the ethics committee, falsified campaign finance documents, lied under oath.
Took a lot of money
and spent
it on cocaine. His wife took a lot of money.
He had a drug problem. He had a serious drug problem.
Yeah,
and he is in jail. And that's a tragedy. And it is not apples to apples to compare Aaron Schock and say there is an unfairness based on race. I don't think that's fair.
It's much more like the Kettlemans, you know.
Kettlemans in Better Call Saul, which is our favorite show now.
They were both criminals, but I don't think the Kettlemans ever bought drugs. Jesse Jackson.
But it's like the Kettlemans in that Aaron Schock doesn't think the rules apply to him.
Right, exactly. But the difference is Aaron Schock. Falsified mileage and bought Katy Perry tickets.
Yep.
Jesse Jackson Jr. took money and bought cocaine.
Yeah.
So there is an actual difference between the two. But and I think the point being, the only point I was trying to make is I get why Joy-Ann Reid would go here. I know that she's trying to make a comparison. We do have two Congress people who've gone to jail, but we have a whole bunch of people who've gone to jail. We couldn't quite come up with the right number. This is an actual true story. We were at a trivia night. We do that. That's our wild night out to go to trivia contest. Yes. Yeah. And it was how many Illinois governors have gone to jail? And we, first of all, got it right.
We did. It was four.
But secondly,
yes.
How many governors have gone to jail? But secondly, it was like, okay, how many were actual crooks?
Yeah. Wait a minute, are we talking convicted or are we talking just arraigned?
Right. There's a couple of cases where they bribed their way out of and then rewarded them, the jury afterwards with
state jobs. The whole jury got state jobs after the trial. Yeah.
Was that guilty? Is that not guilty? And was some, you know, one died before he went to jail? Does that count?
Yeah, we were really having to go through and make check marks of which four went to prison.
And that's just governors. Aldermen, every spring, it's like, you know, the cherry blossoms bloom and the fish, you have a giant fish kill in the lake, all the dead alewives.
You're talking about Chicago aldermen. This doesn't happen in Springfield. No.
Chicago aldermen. But in Illinois, we have a vast and noble history of deep and wide political corruption. Mm-hmm. And I think the fairest comparison would be Dan Rostenkowski, who was an incredibly powerful House Ways and Means Committee chairman who just, and I looked this up too, was pardoned by Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. He did, in fact, you know, cash stamps out that he got for free from money. He took some bribes. He did some mail fraud. He did the things you're not supposed to do. But Gerry Ford, of all people, if I read this correctly, Gerald Ford wrote one letter in his entire presidential or post-presidential career supporting a pardon. And it was for Dan Rostenkowski because they were in Congress together. And he said, Rosty got screwed. Rosty played by the old rules of Chicago, which is like no place else on earth. But in his own little terrarium there, he was completely within the rules. The rules just changed on him and he couldn't keep up. He couldn't fathom why this was not done anymore. And he did it and he went to jail for it. The difference being that Rostenkowski, like Dick Durbin, you know, Polish guy, rolled up his sleeves and went to work for his constituents. He loved working for his voters. Mm-hmm. He didn't work for his lobbyists. He didn't work for his funders. I'm sure those people played a big part in his life. But Rostenkowski was an old school politician who cared deeply about the people who voted for him, who went to every old folks home, who went to every VFW hall and made sure that constituents were always taken care of. That's where Aaron Schock went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because Aaron Schock cared way more about the next job he was going to have or the next tier on the Republican rise to power.
Or the next trip to the Barbados. I mean, yes. He was, you know, whatever it was. And a good time, Charlie. He was really interested in having a good time with his friend.
And you know what? Yeah. I will take a dedicated public servant who's a little grafty on the side. And who really gets the roads paved and gets the schools built and cares about, you know, labor.
Yeah, Joe put the drywall up in that public school and then gave me a swimming pool tool. He did a great job. You know, that's how it got done in Chicago. Yeah.
And that's a different battle. That's a different political battle, in my point of view, than the fight against the Republican Party writ large, which has become this massive, well-funded, deeply corrupt, incredibly dangerous fascistic machine designed by billionaires to
remove
crush
democracy from the United States of
America. To wipe democracy out.
Yeah.
In the name of democracy, you know, to wipe democracy out in the name of freedom.
Yeah.
And replace it with direct corporate control of our government.
That's a totally different ball of wax. Absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
And that's the war you and I are fighting. That's the war liberals like us are fighting every day. The old school political battles are almost, I'm nostalgic for those. Mm-hmm. Those were the good old days, believe it or not.
Well, speaking of that, I think we need to talk about the Republican Party for a while now.
Oh, must we?
First of all, no one's talking about Bill O'Reilly anymore.
Yeah. Notice that. This is week two. This I'm not sure if this will become a regular feature on the show, but let's mark the number of weeks when everyone forgets Bill O'Reilly even exists.
Yeah.
Because the strategy worked, didn't it?
Yep.
It was just hunker down, lock the door on the bunker, deny, deny, deny. If for those of you who are fans of Guide for the Married Man, which is a movie from the 60s, go look it up on YouTube. It's the Joey Bishop portion, where what do you do if you're caught naked in bed with a woman who's not your wife by your wife? And the answer is deny it, just deny it, just deny it, deny everything. And Roger Ailes is a genius because he understands the American people. He certainly understands his viewers. And he understands that if you just lock it down, deny everything at the top of your voice, scream liberal conspiracy loud enough, eventually the
and remind everyone that your ratings are great. So that
awesome.
Means something.
And
yeah.
They're going because I'll tell you at the headquarters of mainstream media America, they don't look at the truth or lying. They don't go to Snopes first thing in the morning. They go to check the ratings first thing in the morning.
Yep.
You go to see who's up and who's down. That's what they care about. And by that measure, Bill O'Reilly is a Godzilla. He's awesome. So Roger Ailes knows full well that if he just hunkers down and denies everything and everybody – and this is really important because this is part of the next thing we're going to talk about. If everybody falls into line. If all of the people goose step in exactly the same way, exactly the same beat, then everything will be fine. Eventually, Rachel Maddow will give up being the only person screaming about this, and the next crisis will come along, and people will say, well, yeah, but look, both sides. It's Bill O'Reilly, for God's sakes. They're not a real news organization. Let's just leave it be. And they'll get away with it because they've been getting away with it for 20 years now. Why shouldn't they keep getting away with it? People in the mainstream media are terrified of Fox News, A, because they plan to have jobs there someday.
Yep.
And B, because they can get wiped out. Because if the Fox News hate machine swings their guns at you, They can take you out. Look at what's happening to MSNBC. It's turning into Fox Lite plus a little CNN because the person running it is a corporation. They don't give a shit about my issues. They don't give a shit about liberalism. They give a shit about money and ratings. And apparently my viewership is not sufficient enough to make Phil Griffin happy. So he wants to kick me to the curb and try to get a cut of that CNN Fox viewership. God bless him. I'm not going to watch him if that happens. But on the other end of that spectrum, the trick to holding it all together is everybody goes along with it.
Yep. Yep.
Nobody breaks ranks. Nobody.
You mean like Mickey Katz?
And Mickey Katz stepped over the line, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yes,
sure.
Tell us what happened to Mickey Katz. Let's get into that.
Mickey is a writer for a squalid little fascist publication called The Daily Caller, which is run by Tucker Carlson. And you might know Tucker Carlson from
Merit hire Tucker Carlson.
Yes, yes. Yeah. The hat tip to Charlie Pierce. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Margaret Carlson's idiot son, who basically whelped him into his own career. You might know Tucker Carlson as the bow-tied, baby-faced, lying shitbag who cannot be fired. He's one half of the Crossfire clown show that Jon Stewart burned to the ground. But boom, he's Tucker Carlson used to have his own show on MSNBC. Tucker Carlson has it works on Fox News. Tucker Carlson is one of those indestructible wingnut mouthpieces that it doesn't matter what they say or do. It doesn't matter how badly they lie.
Because he has connections inside the Beltway.
Because he's
that is really what it is.
He's a friend of the money guys.
Yep.
And so he can never be fired. Well, so Mickey Cass or Kaus, I'm not sure how it's pronounced because I've never met him in person. I've never heard anyone say his name out loud. So pardon me for mispronouncing him. Stepped off the reservation.
Yeah.
He wrote an article for the Daily Caller.
Let's talk about how he stepped off the reservation.
That's really funny.
Because a lot of people are stepping off this reservation. Yeah. Glenn Beck stepped off, and today, or yesterday, Eric, son of Erickson, stepped off the reservation. There are Republicans who are really mad that the Republican Party is not succeeding at undoing Obamacare and immigration. And
exactly.
Because they're not being strident enough to have a win, they promised us that they would win.
Uh-huh.
And I personally think that the real fear in the Congress is about XL Pipeline, that the Koch brothers are going to be breaking some kneecaps, because that was the number one thing that was promised from Mitch McConnell. Mm-hmm. We're going to get in there. The first item of business is pass the XL pipeline, and they failed. They failed it. They can't overturn the veto.
They failed,
and they can't overturn Obamacare. And their budget is a joke on the Hill. It's a joke. It's not going to get out of committee.
And so one day they fear Luca Brasi is going to show up and want to have a little talk with him out in the alley. And then you don't hear from them no more. Yeah. Oh, Tucker Carlson. Oh, we won't see him no more.
Yeah, right.
So this is how they operate. Yeah,
Mickey Katz is really his thing is immigration, right?
Exactly.
That's his big thing is we've got to undo everything Barack Obama did on immigration.
Amnesty.
Die on that hill. And this is that's the word that Eric Erickson used in his column was, what hill do you want to die on? Because we have to die on a hill. And these Republicans don't want to die on any hills. They're always planning their surrender. The minute they announce their stand on any issue, they're plotting surrender.
And if I could just add as a sidebar, if Eric Erickson would like to lead them up the hill and let them die there, I will pay the trip. I will pay for the ticket. If you want to lead them up to the top of the hill and let them perish above the snake line, knock yourself out. I urge you to do that. But yeah, the Fox News has a siege gun. Okay, that's what they are—a massive, the guns of Navarone. They have this massive siege engine. They can just pound away on an issue and beat Republican politicians into the ground. They can force them to toe the line, just like Rush Limbaugh. Just like you have to kiss Rush Limbaugh's ring to be permitted back into the Republican Party. Fox News has this George Rails has built this gigantic Death Star.
Mm-hmm.
They can kill anything he points it at. And what Mickey Kaus was mad about was he was putting it at ISIS.
Yeah.
He was bitching about ISIS and terrorism, and that's not the issue he wanted Republicans to obsess over, because that wasn't his issue. He wanted them to be giant assholes about immigration as opposed to being giant assholes about terrorism. So he was pissed that they weren't focusing
dying on the hill of immigration. Yeah.
His specific issue. And so he wrote a column to that effect. And
critical of Fox News.
Critical of Fox News. And Tucker Carlson pulled it.
Yep.
And Mickey Coon was shocked to discover gambling was going on at Rick.
That's one of your commenters pointed out.
He was completely fucking indignant. And quit
working for the Daily Caller over it. Yeah.
Quit on principle. And I'll get to that in a minute. But Tucker Carlson said, look, I don't see how I can not have this rule. I'm employed by Fox. It's the only way I can handle it. I would like you to stay on.
That was the quote that Kaus gave to the Washington Post. Yeah. Summing up Carlson's approach. Said, yeah.
I work at Fox. I can't say shit like this, which as a brief aside. You know, I will dance and sing on this particular burial site all night long. Mm-hmm. But, you know, MSNBC, if you want to find out why your network is broken, just go down the hall.
Yeah.
Point a camera at Chuck Todd and start asking questions. But you're not going to do that either. So I'm not nobody's hands are clean here. No. But Republican hands are filthy up to the elbows.
And
because they're all in.
I don't want either side in this case to win. I mean, it doesn't matter. We just grab the popcorn and watch it. But I thought it was interesting that Tucker Carlson doesn't understand why everybody isn't a sellout. You know, just keep your job. We want you to stay. I like you. And just sell out your principles because that's what I do, you know.
Which is what I was reminded of Keith Olbermann's exchange with Sean Hannity.
Oh, my God.
Where Olbermann is saying, look, as Sean and I were on like a panel and we were debating or arguing or whatever. And during the break or when cameras were off, Sean's laughing. It's like, isn't it funny? They think that we don't like each other. You know, that we hate each other.
And Olbermann said, we don't. You're not my friend.
But Hannity said, but it's just TV.
Yeah.
It's just a show. I know I'm a whore. I know I dress up in a costume and make the pig people jump up and dance and froth at the mouth. That's what they pay me to do. I make a fuckload of money doing that. Everyone I know, everyone in the industry I know makes an assload of money telling stupid people that their paranoia is actually patriotism. That's the game. We all know it. You just can't say it. And the thing is, Tucker Carlson doesn't understand why Mickey didn't get the fucking memo. This is the game we play. This is what we're paid to do. That's how I have a job at Fox, is I do what Roger Ailes tells me to do. When he jumps, when he says jump, I say how high. And here's the part that just made me laugh out loud. Mickey was going on about how this isn't Joe's mechanic shop. We're not a muffler shop. You know, we're a news organization. And a news organization can't have these giant areas that you're not allowed to report on. And I just sat there going, man, this really is what happens to the tribe that rubs shit in its hair.
Yeah.
At some point, you forget that you're a part of a cult. Mickey is sitting in – Mickey, you're a whore.
Yeah.
You work in a whore house. And you and you picked a fight with the madam over a matter of integrity. And it's just – it was surreal that he doesn't understand that he's a prostitute.
Yeah.
That's what he does. And that's where his money comes from. And somehow he lost sight of that. He like lots of people in the second and third tier, the Breitbart scumbags and the rest of them, they really believe their own shit. They really believe James O'Keefe is a noble investigative journalist. And they react accordingly. And so when their worlds collide with reality, they get this incredibly rude shock because everyone's laughing at you. Or everyone is either laughing at you, Mickey, because you don't understand the game you're playing, or you suddenly realize you've been writing for morons. You've been writing for dupes. You've been writing for sheep this entire time. And those are the two parts of your party. The brain cast who tells the sheep what to do and the paranoid morons who do it. And that's really all there is to it. And you forgot that. You thought you were for a news organization.
And Tucker Carlson realizes that. I mean, you got to give Tucker credit for saying, look, you know, the thing to do is sell out like I did. That's what you do.
Yeah.
And stay on because I like you and I'll keep you on. And, you know, you can make money doing this.
The rotten apples can fall far for the rotten tree, you know?
Yeah.
That's the state of the GOP. That's the state of the media over there. And it has consequences. I mean, this is not something that's happening in a vacuum. And one of the consequences stood up and asked Rick Santorum a question this week.
Oh, my gosh. Please. This woman, this crazy. I mean, we've had this before with John McCain. This has happened. And it's going to happen again. Katie Abrams.
That's
exactly
how she started her career.
Yep.
That's how she got national attention, by standing up at a town meeting and
ranting. That's how she got health insurance from the Koch brothers. Yep.
That's how she got her job. So we have the mandatory crazy lady standing up. And again, she asked very, I thought, ridiculous policy questions. But you heard her voice change when the crazy came out. And
And she was talking right out of Glenn Beck's mouth to her brain. It was just regurgitated.
These are the words that Glenn Beck tinkered together and put in her head. This is your crazy Uncle Liberty. This is what his email inbox looks like.
Yep.
This woman's brain looks like the
Barack Obama is nuking Charleston, yes. South Carolina.
He was trying to nuke Charleston. But she stood up and she said, you Republicans have disappointed me. We put you in Congress. She told Rick Santorum, who is not in Congress. He's not an elected official anymore. But she's bitching that we put you people in Congress to get rid of Obamacare and to roll back his tyrannical executive immigration, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Okay, straight up Republican talking points. We told you to get in there and make this guy kneel and do what he's told because we're in charge of this country. We took our country back. And you didn't do it. You're playing footsie with him. And then the crazy comes out. He's a communist tyrant and he must be taken down. He is destroying America. And
and he wants to nuke a major American city.
He ordered Charleston to be nuked.
Nuked, yes.
And he fired all the generals who wouldn't go along with his plan to steal America's guns and then shoot civilians once the uprising began or some shit like that. Again, this is straight.
And there was a commenter on Facebook who said, this is when you really want to find a FEMA camp.
Yeah, and
to
hide
put this
there.
Lady in it.
Yeah. No, I want to find the Alexandria free zone. Safe zone and hide there because she's the walking
dead.
She's the mindless, millions of mindless zombies are stomping across this country and she's one of them. So she opens her mouth and the entire history of conservative talk radio comes roaring out. All right, this is the monster they built. They built this woman from the ground up to give them money, to give them rating, to give them votes, and to give them their passion, give them power. Harness enough of these losers together and you have a mighty machine. So this is the woman they built, right? And she's standing up and the crazy is just pouring out of her mouth. And what does Rick Santorum do?
Coward.
He's a coward. Yeah. He's a douchebag and he is as scummy as they come. He is an immoral, cowardly. And what makes it worse is he thumps the Bible.
Yep.
You know, the people who really stand on the Bible to ply their whorish trade are the worst. And Rick Santorum piously reminds her that he wasn't a part of Congress when this all happened. So he takes no responsibility for this. And by the way, since you mentioned tyrant, tyrant is not inappropriate. Barack Obama is behaving like a tyrant and he's off to the races. At no point did he said, you're crazy, bitch,
and
sit
you're
down.
Wrong. Yeah.
At no point did he even take her hand like John McCain and say, no, ma'am.
No, ma'am.
That's wrong.
Yeah.
Because that's his base. That's his party. That's not a branch of his party. It's not a sector of his party. He's enough of a politician to know he's looking into the eyes of the monster he built. He helped make that person. And now they're in charge.
And they're in charge by reading Dick Cheney's interview in Playboy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because, Dick Cheney went off on some really crazy tangents like, we're in China's knickers and they're in ours, or we're deep in each other's knickers, I think he said. And he made some racist comments. I mean, it was just, it's a wide-ranging interview and there's a lot of gold to mine in there. But the part where he talks about Obama as being the worst president in his lifetime comes straight out of Uncle Liberty emails.
Oh, yeah.
And you can tell that there is some anxiety on the part of Dick Cheney that he is going to be left in the dustbin by the American right, by the base of the Republican Party, who wants to forget about him. That's why the Tea Party was created, was to make people forget that they'd ever voted for this torturing war criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does he do to get legitimacy back? He goes to Playboy
uh-huh.
and where he's going to get a lot of media attention for getting an interview there.
Uh-huh.
And reads crazy Uncle Liberty emails about the worst president in American history, Barack Obama.
He's dangerous. You know, he's.
And it's a tragedy. It's a real tragedy. Yeah. What a bad president he is.
He's making it impossible for future presidents to fight terrorism. Really,
mm-hmm.
He's ruining this country. And at this point, there's nothing left to say about the right. I mean, we're going to continue this podcast until we stop having fun doing it. There's nothing to be said other than let's set the Bill O'Reilly clock again.
Yeah,
at what point will we all agree to forget that this crazy bitch popped up in the middle of a meeting and out of her mouth came the entire history of right-wing talk radio?
Mm-hmm.
At what point will we forget that Rick Santorum is a coward and a scumbag?
He kowtowed to her. Yes, he kowtowed to her crazy. Yep.
Well, what point will Dick Cheney's America's Pinochet, at what point will this latest atrocity against democracy and truth and history just slide into history, just be forgotten? It goes
well,
away.
St. Peter is going to greet Dick Cheney as a liberator.
Yeah, I'm sure he will. I have less faith in the ultimate outcome of the human soul than my wife does. But in the here and now, there isn't any point anymore in pretending this is across the board. Charlie Pierce had a lovely column today. You know, I read Charlie Pierce. I know he reads me. I talk about him a lot more than he talks about me, but that'll change over time, I'm sure. As my star rises and his, because he tied his, let's face it, he tied his boats to MSNBC. He's going to sink along with him. Sorry, Charlie.
Hey, Drifas, happy blogiversary, by the way. I've been meaning.
Oh, yeah.
Happy 10-year blogiversary, Drifas.
10 years. I know that I talked about getting laid off, and believe me, I am touched by people's concern and generosity and suggestions. I have been unable to lift a pen to say thank you. I've been doing some writing, but there's something about that process that just hurts a little bit, and I don't want to do it just now. But I am not going to eschew doing a fundraiser.
Yeah.
For my 10-year blogiversary. What I will probably do is dredge out some of my favorite columns for the last 10 years. What I threaten to do.
You're not going to do this.
No, I won't.
You can tell people what you were threatening to do.
I will just run every substantive David Brooks column I've ever written in order, every hour on the hour for however long that takes. It would take a really long time. I've written probably 1,000 of them, 1,500 of them over the years. I no hyperbole. I am the most expert person, the most knowledgeable person about David Brooks's writing, his history, his preferences, and his effect on the media.
Speaking of which, I want to switch
gears
world. Real quick.
One more thing. The degree to which disgust. People are just giving up on the right. People are just saying, you know what? There's no point in arguing with these people anymore. It's just pointless. Let's argue with the centrists who enable them. But that's Charlie Pierce and it's Jon Stewart.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He just had it. Jon Stewart is turning into, in a way, I think it's still Jon Stewart's brilliant and funny and all those good things. But Jon Stewart's turning into Mort Saul. Going on stage with the Warren Commission report and just lecturing people on it. Jon Stewart has obviously reached the point. Remember, like 5 years ago or less than that, he had his big rally
to restore sanity,
and
yes.
He was still like begging people, let's all get along, well, left and right, and you and
let's
me
not
and
call
the,
each other Hitler after, let's not do that
you.
Yeah,
and let's because you know both sides are there, and he I totally understand, he desperately wanted it to be true. He desperately wanted this to be an interlocking problem where both sides were gripped together, and they had some sort of death grip on each other. If we could both just let go.
Hang it up. Yeah.
And it turned out that's not true. No, one side of the political spectrum is an active enemy of democracy, mm-hmm. and is getting stronger and more aggressive and more vicious and more willing to do crazy shit to win and hold power. And the other side is not. The other side has all of the problems I've heard before, and I'll agree with all of them. But one side isn't actively insane and vicious and dangerous. And Jon Stewart finally said, fuck it. Yeah. There's no point in laughing at this anymore. They're scary and they're nuts and they're coming for you and they're coming for me. And we've got to stop these fuckers.
Yeah.
And it's coming.
And
to the
he's
point-
climbing over his desk on a regular basis, yeah. Just furious. Just
and
furious.
Yeah. So the bandwidth of people who make mock of everyone, you know, these are the canaries in the mine shaft. Those are the people who have said, you know what? It's really hard to keep pretending that this is a two-sided problem. It just isn't. Yep. The problem is the media who keeps pretending it's a two-sided problem and giving an alibi, an out to intellectually lazy or cowardly people who don't want to take a side in what is a modern civil war.
Yeah.
So that was my interruption. I do apologize.
Well, and I want to thank our listener, Dan, who has sent us information about the 92nd Street Y, and there's this series of interviews that Jeff Greenfield is giving, and this week it was Chuck Todd who got to sit for a couple of hours and ruminate with Jeff Greenfield, and talking about their one of their favorite conservative thinkers, Hugh Hewitt, who is really a policy wonk, versus Rush Limbaugh, you know, who's an entertainer.
He's very smart, Hugh Hewitt.
Yeah, Hugh Hewitt's very smart and a thinker.
He's a policy guy, really.
And a policy guy, really. And but no mention of the influence that Rush Limbaugh has on the Congress, on the voters, on the electorate as a whole, that, you know, 40% of the American electorate and more in midterm elections decides who to vote for, decides how passionately to vote
and
because
what
of Rush
and what,
Limbaugh,
and
what the issues are.
Exactly, exactly.
From Rush Limbaugh.
From one guy.
One guy.
And from one TV network.
And
as well.
And yeah. Jeff Greenfield dismisses him. No, no, he's an entertainer. And I want to say, so Sandra Fluke being a slut, that's just entertainment, right?
That's just funny. It's just a joke. You can't take a joke, Blue Gal. It was a joke.
Okay.
Yeah, that's an Ann Coulter joke.
Yeah. Okay.
But that's right there, that little moment there where Hugh Hewitt, who is a monster, and Rush Limbaugh, who's a monster without filters.
Yes.
It Jeff Greenfield and Chuck Todd, who are really at the very pinnacle of the mainstream centrist corporate Washington D.C. Beltway media. They set the agenda. They decide what we're going to talk.
Well, and the 92nd Street Y too. The whole Acela corridor.
It's that crowd. Won't at the point of a shotgun acknowledge that Rush Limbaugh is not an entertainer. Rush Limbaugh is the fucking Republican Party.
Yeah.
Because once that domino falls, everything else falls behind it. Once you acknowledge, look, and go to his office, look at the plaque on Limbaugh's wall that says he's the majority maker from 1994. That was 20 years ago. 20 years ago, Rush Limbaugh was deciding Republican elections. And Republicans were kissing his ring. It's been going on for two decades. And after two decades, a complete media bag, just a sack of skin who just wants to get to retirement and maybe go away and do some reporting on some fun stuff. These two guys cannot acknowledge that Rush Limbaugh is the problem, can't acknowledge that Hugh Hewitt is the problem or that there is any problem. There's just this entertainer on one side and this seriously policy guy on the other. There's one guy. There's this one party. There's this one mind. And it really is Lee Atwater. It's the bastard children of Lee Atwater. And it is what my big wish is that one day I will be in a bar with Jeff Greenfield and Chuck Todd and me and like three other guys who are kind of intimidating. And we don't want to hurt you, but we really, really want you to. You're not going to go anywhere until we sit down and have a talk about why it is you cannot form your mouth to say the words, the Republican Party is insane, when it is patently obvious to any four-year-old who's ever attended a Ted Cruz rally that they are. So why can't you? And the answer is obviously is money. So, and then we have to have a different conversation about the media and a different conversation about what's broken. But we'll never get to that conversation as long as these guys are the gatekeepers and as long as we keep pretending that they're telling us anything like the truth. They're not. Their job is to hide the truth, not tell us the truth.
Yeah. So let's talk about Starbucks.
Yeah.
And this
racism solved. You know?
Oh, well, there's a lady in Nevada who said that to a colored fella, as she put it. One of her colored colleagues. She said, racism over. We have a black president.
Yeah.
So, And she's an elected official. I just want to say she's an elected official.
Green Party?
Yeah, no.
Democrat leaning
I found it interesting that social media and our friends in the millennial generation, as I mentioned last week, have very little patience for clueless CEOs and corporations that want them to be socially aware of racial issues.
Or anything.
And write them on the cup and have a talk with your barista about race, because that'll be really great.
Because when you were in your 20s in the 70s, you used to sit around on beanbag chairs.
Yeah, and smoke pot and rap. Yeah, and that was really cool. So this would be really cool if our corporate structure demands that people, while they're purchasing our product, become social engines for change, right?
While they're purchasing our product and from people who are tired and grumpy and pissed and don't want to hear about it, who have 10 other people who are tired and grumpy and pissed behind them.
Behind them, exactly.
Let's have a conversation
and,
about race.
Well, and so a lot of millennials on social media had a conversation about race today. And the conversation that they had was that in the corporate offices of Starbucks, 16% of the people that work in that area are people of color. But down in the barista area, it's 40% people of color.
Oh, my.
And Starbucks is notoriously anti-union. They pay their baristas around a little under $8 an hour. And there were quite a number of, at least on my Tumblr account, pictures of Starbucks cups with Fight for 15 written on them. Because that's an issue about race, too. Fair pay and a living wage.
I'm sorry, you didn't get the memo, Blue Gal. We're not talking about class warfare today. We're talking about race day, because race and class have
because
nothing
CEO,
to do with each other.
The CEO of Starbucks has already won the class war.
Yeah. Like, well, like Warren Buffett said, class war is over, my side won.
Yeah.
But we're not going to talk about class, because that's scary.
Yeah.
And we're also not going to talk about the fact that poverty is in some way related to how much money you're paid.
And the color of your skin in large part. Absolutely.
We're not going to talk about any of that shit. We're not going to talk about any of that. We're going to talk about race. And we're going to do it in a coffee shop, because that's where these problems. And there are lots of venues. There are lots of places to have a really deep and rich and interesting conversation about race. You don't need a guide. It's helpful to sort of have someone you trust and you like, and you can sort of open up with a little bit and talk and be free to make mistakes. It has to be a conversation where you're free to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. But everything about this screams, holy shit, a billionaire with a terrible idea and nobody around him to tell him that's wrong.
Yep, because he's only 16% people of color in the corporate offices at Starbucks. That's why.
let me draw a sharp distinction between the race problem at Starbucks and the Republican Party, if I may. You know, I'm going to stretch a point to make a point. The clueless CEO will be corrected by the marketplace.
There is,
in fact, a negative feedback loop built into the marketplace, which is pretty ruthless and pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And it will inform you, like New Coke, that you have stepped out of the area where your audience and customers want you to go, and they're going to go someplace else. Because you know what? There's a Caribou right down the street, and Dunkin' Donuts is making pretty good coffee now, and there's like a million other places for me to go for my overpriced latte. Yeah. Goodbye. So the marketplace has built into it a corrective negative feedback loop. And eventually, your stupid idea is going to come back to you, no matter how many yes men you put around you, and it will grab you by the lapels and tell you you did something stupid. Now it's time to get your PR people to gently back you out of it. Yeah. There is no such negative feedback loop built into the Republican Party. There's no longer any center right, any reasonable conservatives who stand outside of the lunatic mob and say, this has gone too far. This is ridiculous. There's no CEO in charge who will listen to reason anymore. There's Roger Ailes and Rush Limbaugh. They don't want to hear.
And Roger Ailes is an expert at changing the subject if things get out of hand.
That's
right. He just tells the pig people to think about something else. We'll go back to Benghazi. We'll go to ISIL. We'll go to
emails.
Anything. Email.
That's the Fury.
Hillary's email.
Yeah.
My favorite comment of the week, actually, this week was from one of my Twitter friends, when I pointed out that maybe the House Budget Committee could figure out how many gallons of primer it was going to take to cover those red walls in the Downton Abbey office.
Yeah.
And someone replied and said, oh no, they're just going to paper it over with Hillary email.
Gotta do it.
That'll do it. Absolutely. Yeah, no, Roger Ailes is just very, very good at, no, that we're getting in trouble here, we're just going to change the subject.
Yeah.
You know who else is good at papering over problems? Micah Brzezinski.
Oh, yeah.
She's
one of your favorites. She's your David Brooks.
She's my David Brooks.
She's your David Brooks.
She just, I feel punched in the gut when I see ads for her, you know, Women in the boardroom need to ask for more money, because we need to lean forward and be assertive about our worth. And that does not help any African-American barista in the world. It does not. And she has won the class war. That's what she's done. And now she's fighting within her winner's circle for who's going to get the most money.
You're the big news daughter. Look to your left and right and see who you're hanging out with. Yeah. You know, Charlie Pierce, again, I think I'm quoting, if the place where Mike Barnicle finally landed is setting the national agenda, then the Republic is lost.
Yeah.
You know, you're working at essentially the Daily Caller Lite with a lot more money.
But it was her job. It was Micah Brzezinski's job to go on MSNBC the next day when it was clear that Joe Scarborough and Bill Kristol had fucked the pooch.
Oh, yeah. And tell what happened. Mention what happened.
She goes on and she's in one way.
How they did it.
How they did what?
Bill Kristol.
Oh, well, they went. Joe Scarborough and Bill Kristol, we talked about this last week, said that the fraternity boys who were singing on the bus about the N-word, you know, they got all that from rap music, and corporations make money off of rap music, and there's not much we can do about it.
So the real villain
it influences
here.
These kids, and then they repeat what they've heard, and that's what... No.
The real villain here is black rap music.
Was a right. The real villain here is black rap music that uses the N-word.
Right.
No, this was actually a Civil War era... We are excluding N-words from our fraternity.
Yeah.
Classic song.
Antebellum, if you will.
Antebellum from a fraternity that prides itself on its antebellum heritage.
And so what did Mika have to do the next day? Because
she had to be on MSNBC next in a window, and the next window next to her was Reverend Al.
Yes.
And she had to talk about how deeply disturbing she found the fraternity song, that she found it disturbing and troubling. That they would sing this song, and someone on Twitter said that maybe if they just said we don't want any African Americans at SAE, it would be less disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
Because that difference for Micah and for the CEO of Starbucks, the conversation about race is, look, we're all basically good people here, we don't use the N-word. So you know, we really believe in. Fair treatment, and that means that we have enough class to not use the N-word, and that makes us good people.
And when we go over the line,
but we don't talk about class or money or taxation or anything that's going to make your life less comfortable, Micah Brzezinski.
And when angry stupid daddy goes over the line, it's the job of nice mommy to come out the next day and make pancakes for everybody.
Yep.
Oh, Joe Scarborough never said that. And it's Al Sharpton's job to do Al Sharpton always does. Come in and take the curse off.
Yep.
You know, Al Sharpton played Al Sharpton.
And frown and be stern about it.
He's there to dole out forgiveness in exchange for money. That's what he does. It reminded me, because Al Sharpton is certainly self-aware enough to know that Al Sharpton played Al Sharpton on Boston Legal.
Yes, he did.
And he was the wild card that William Shatner could pull out to save a trial. Al Sharpton busts into the trial, and as Al Sharpton with a bunch of media behind him talking about the racism involved in this, and turns the trial around. That's his job.
Yep.
His job is to show up and do his thing. And lend his
to both expose white guilt and then forgive it
and collect money on both ends of
and provide and provide atonement. He provides an opportunity for atonement to the wealthy whites at MSNBC who want to collect their paycheck and pay the lowest amount of payroll tax in the history of this country.
Well,
we want to keep
people like Joe Scarborough on the air for reasons that are unfathomable, for being paid more than anybody else on MSNBC, given more time than anybody else on MSNBC, and put people like Bill Kristol on as his guests, shame themselves and shit themselves in public almost every single day. And then we troll out the lady and the African-American guy to say,
Make it okay.
It's okay. We're good people here. And they go collect their paychecks for that. And
we are so running out of time right now, we got to cover Tom Friedman before we go.
Holy shit, Tom Friedman.
What was this column? I read it and I don't get it.
It's Tom Friedman thinking, forgetting that he is the same Tom Friedman who got us into the Iraq War.
Yeah.
Now he would like to know why the U.S. is fighting Iran's wars for it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, because we hollowed out the country that was propped up against it because you thought that was a good idea because suck on this. I mean,
again,
I want to hear Tom Friedman's recipe for duck a l'orange. I want to hear his travelogue, his travels in Europe, and what sort of wines he has with eating crow, which he has never done. I want to hear all those things, but I never, ever, ever want to hear, and this isn't a personal preference. This is simply a fact that Tom Friedman has absolutely no business opening his fucking pie hole and ever writing about the Middle East again.
Yet that's all he talks about.
Yeah. And the reason he talks about it is because Pinch Schulzberger lets him do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he gives him a platform and gives him, and I'm convinced. So Tom Friedman said, maybe we should arm ISIS. Maybe we should be on their side. You know, I'm not saying we should. I'm saying as a rhetorical device.
And nobody called him on his BlackBerry and said, Tom, you're fired.
No. Yeah. And nobody in the last 20 years has called Tom Friedman on any device and told him anything but good job, Tom.
Yeah.
You know, that World is Flat book that changed my fucking life, man. It was awesome. You know,
terrible. You
know? And because he flies from TED Talk to TED Talk to Aspen
to Davos, and that's
to
it.
Davos.
Aspen to
and
Davos.
Then he skims through India to pick up a cab driver to tell him what's going on the world and writes that down and comes back and says, you know what's going on? The internet, China, and jobs. Oh my God. Oh my God. That's Tom Friedman. And Tom Friedman, I wrote a column many, many years ago that I'm not going to bore you with, but it was about maybe people will start talking about Iraq now. You know, why aren't people? And it was just, I just wanted to scream when I heard this because, of course, the people who have their head up your ass, the only people you listen to, Tom Friedman, of course, are not having that conversation. Everyone else is, but you live in this, and you know he's a billionaire, right? You know, Tom Friedman.
He's a real estate billionaire. Yeah.
He married into a real estate fortune. He is a big B billionaire. And he gets to write about the same subject he shit himself in public on for decades, and nobody calls him on it. But
and grand bargain, and no one calls him on it.
Yeah. And everything. He's just a joke. And at some level, the Schulzberger family has to know he's a joke. But you line them all up next to each other. There's Ross Douthat. Oh my God. There's Maureen Dowd, and her obsession with Bambi Obama and her really seething contempt for the Clintons. Just uncontrollable Irish, drunken, I'm never going to get laid again, rage against the Clinton family that's boundless. And then, of course, there's David Brooks, the crown jewel of the shitheads.
And you really think that this is some sort of very weird social experiment that Schulzbergers are putting on.
What else could it be?
Yeah.
Let's give. There was a movie, I forget, it was, I remember the W.C. Field was in it. A millionaire dies and gives $1 million to a bunch of people. Says, do whatever you want with it.
Mm-hmm.
And W.C. Fields buys a bunch of cars, which he uses to run other cars off the road because that's the people that used to bother him.
Mm-hmm.
So he just deploys them and knocks the bad drivers off the road. And that's how he enjoys himself. But part of me is like, what else, what other possible explanation could there be for employing someone who so publicly humiliated himself over and over again, who's literally beyond touch? I mean, he lives in heaven. These people live on a different plane of existence because nothing we do can touch them. Nothing we say reaches them. No amount of shitting themselves in public ever sticks to them. So I'm like, okay, here's what they tried to do. This is like, you know, that 7-Up, 14-Up movie where you film every 7 years, or like Boyhood, they filmed the same guy for 12 years. I think it's part of a social experiment. Pinch Schulzberg is like, okay, what if we took the four most horrible people we know and gave them unlimited, unaccountable money, a bottomless expense account to go wherever they want, no reviews of their work whatsoever, and no accountability of any kind, and let them grow, let them flower, let them blossom into these awesome, horrible creatures. And what would happen? It's like an evolutionary experiment. Let the thing in the petri dish just run completely out of control and see what happens. Because
the one thing you find out is that none of them can say three little words. I was wrong.
And worse,
they cannot say that.
Liberals were right.
And liberals were right. Yeah.
So
hey,
Brooks,
we are at an hour.
Oh yeah, you're right. Let's save it for next week.
We'll save it.
Next week, we're going to be a little bit different.
We're going to be a little different. We're going to have a show coming out on Thursday at some point. Uh-huh. So you can always download it at whatever time during the weekend you usually do. But things are crazy with kids being launched for spring break. So we're going to be putting up a podcast on Thursday. And that will be there for you that weekend. I wanted to thank a listener who had a 2-for-1 deal on Rolling Stone magazine and offered it to us. And we've been getting Rolling Stone in our P.O. box. There was a cover page article in the latest issue about the hip-hop rap star Kendrick Lamar.
Okay.
And somebody I know nothing about.
Yeah.
But it caught my eye. It was a typical kind of profile of this poor black kid from Compton, California, mm-hmm. who made it big and bought a Mercedes and bought, you know, all of the trappings of a music star.
Uh-huh.
But the one part that they highlighted and that really caught my eye was when he bought his mother a house and his mother was worried because she was going to lose Section 8.
Uh-huh.
If he bought her a house, and he said, "It's okay, Mom, we're good."
Uh-huh.
And I know how that feels because you can't get Section 8 back if you get it. I mean, mm-hmm. the people trample each other to get Section 8 these days. So yep. and, she and yeah. Go ahead.
I mean pretty much every SNAP the supplemental nutrition program is being cut by billions of dollars in the Paul Ryan budget. Pretty much everything to help people like that.
But they're keeping the savings from Obamacare. They're just getting rid of the Obamacare. Yeah, this is so awful.
This is not her being lazy or a moocher.
No.
This is her understanding how tenuous poverty is and how if you slip and you fall and you've given up your life preserver, you'll drown.
It is like Walking Dead in, you know, if we're going to get weak. If we get comfortable, we're going to get weak. And so if we let... if I let my son buy me a house when he now has $1 million to buy me a house, I'm going to lose Section 8. It's just it shows you the mindset of being poor. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to give people an update on our own situation. We have insurance. I made our first payment on the Obamacare. As I said, you know, it was PTSD last week, but we got it taken care of. I'm still working on getting the kids' insurance taken care of, and I called. We got a letter from the All Kids people, the Medicaid people, saying, "We got your application. We haven't decided yet, but we'll let you know." And I called today and got voicemail at the local office of Medicaid, where, believe it or not, they asked me to leave my name and Social Security number on the voicemail. I am not making that up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just astonishing to have that happen. And I let them know that I was not going to leave my Social Security number on voicemail.
And maybe that's a policy they should look into.
Maybe that's something that they might want to change a policy on. Yeah. We got a letter today, a letter I just loved. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm going to read the last paragraph of this letter from Ben, who writes and says, "I really appreciate how you and Driftglass honestly share your economic challenges and break the code of silenced shame that the corporatized culture has tried to install to keep citizens from recognizing that they are suffering from a collective punishment being inflicted on them by heartless powers who are indifferent to the lives and loves of the common people that they are extracting their wealth from. Reviving a sense of solidarity is the key cultural shift required for the progressive transformation we seek."
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that just beautifully written? And
that's lovely.
Absolutely lovely. True.
Yeah.
We have to break the code of silenced shame that somehow this is our fault, mm-hmm. that we are facing these economic difficulties. And someone sent us one of Barbara Ehrenreich's books about positive thinking.
Ah, and I've been
thinking a lot about that, the idea that the American people are and I use that term in quotation marks, a grateful people. We have an ethos of be grateful for what you have. and know that you're, you know, the greatest country on earth, and always know that there's someone worse off than you out there.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, all of those kind of ethics that we follow have a tendency to paper over injustice that is being done to us.
Yes.
And we need to snap out of that. There is the ability to hold in your mind at the same time gratitude for what you have and a desire and a commitment to fight for justice for yourself as well as other people.
Mm-hmm.
And rising tide raises all boats. We've got to fight for our class of people and everyone below us. And that's just got to happen.
I would go a little one step further. I'd say that gratitude and an awareness of how fortunate you are goes hand in hand with being righteous for justice.
Yeah.
Because it really is a matter of look how much is taken away. Look how much is deprived. Look how much better things could be if only people weren't standing in the way of progress.
Well, and I remember what Chris Hayes has always said too, that it's not going to be the poor and the minimum wage worker that rises up and makes real change in terms of our economic structure. It's going to be people who are educated and middle class and expect that life is going to provide them with decent pay for decent work.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have that expectation in life and it doesn't happen, then that class of people in 19th century France, 21st century America, those are the revolutionaries.
Yep.
Those are the people that transform and make change. And so you're listening to this podcast. You're one of those who's going to fight against that ancien regime as I spit out my education.
Well, and as I spit out my movie trivia, I want to remind people there's a scene from Soylent Green where Charlton Heston's roommate, who's Edward G. Robinson, who were in two movies together, this is Soylent Green, decides to commit suicide, go to the suicide center, the life, you know, termination center, and end his life. And they put him on a table and they close the doors, they close the blinds, and he wants to die looking at nature because nature's gone. There's no more fresh water, there's no more outdoors, there's no more anything. It's all paved over, it's all polluted, it's all dead. And he wants to see, you know, he wants to remember because he's an old man. He remembers when these things were real. And Charlton Heston rushes there to try to save him and can't save him, but forces them to open the shutters and sees what the world used to look like. And he starts crying. He says, how was I supposed to know? How could I know? How could I know that it was ever like this?
Yeah.
And that's what really our generation is trying to do, is trying to desperately trying to remember, to keep in people's minds that we're not nostalgic for the good old days of white supremacy.
Right.
We are nostalgic for a time when we took care of each other and we looked out for each other. And it was expected that everyone would rise together. And if you fell behind, you know, we're a rich enough and a generous enough people that we're going to help you come along. And that was the basic ethos of what was good about this country. And that's what's being robbed from us every day.
Well, and also the internationalization of wealth has led to people not being patriotic about their money. Nope. And they don't owe our country anything when America is what made you this wealthy. I mean, the person that reminds us of that all the time is John Stewart. He says, look, I was able to reach this place because I live in New York City. Therefore, I expect to pay into the culture which made me successful by paying more in taxes because I live here and I've made a success here. That is my obligation to this city and to this state to do this. And we have lost that patriotism in this country.
Uh-huh.
And the biggest douchebags with the largest flag pins are the ones defending people taking their money and putting it in the Caymans, you know.
Yep.
And that's just, now we're getting off on another tangent, which we don't have time for.
We don't have time for that, Luca.
We don't have time for that.
You know, each week.
Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty or two sent in by you, the listeners, or sometimes three. But this week's internet kitties are fox ears and yantar. And I've been told not to ask. Don't ask. Fox Ears and Yantar are on our Facebook page and website. And in this photo, they are playing something called Two Cats, One Lap.
I don't want to know.
I don't want to know. This photo is so adorable that middle child saw it on my computer. She demanded that she receive a printed copy of the photo. So to Fox Ears and Yantar, I say, expect miracles. Middle child has a printed copy of your picture in her room.
She is the cat whisperer.
The cat whisperer. I can't say what's going to happen, but it's going to be good. You've got good things coming your way. Okay. Mm-hmm. You can send your internet kitties to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go Postal Unions! Letter on the air unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us, although we won't spend your money on espresso-based beverages. We'll spend it on our electric bill. Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a contribution, and you can too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, you know, I love the Internet Kitties, Blue Gal, but they did not consult with me or my staff before saying that they're sure I'll be fine unless I go to jail.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2015, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Science Fiction University, we have had a number of responses for Science Fiction University. We've had Dogface Terman write in, Raymond write in. I think Kevin Holtzinger sent something. So I've just had to pick and choose, and I'm cataloging all of this for future science fiction universities. But today we're going to hear from Paul. Paul has a great radio voice.
Paul, the melodious voice, that's right.
And he reads passages from short stories and science fiction novels, and it's so nice of him to do that. This is for all the dickheads out there. That's why I chose it, because I get to say dickheads. What I mean What I mean by that is fans of Philip K. Dick.
Yes.
And this is 11, count them, 11 passages from Philip K. Dick's short stories and novels. Uh-huh. The first five are short stories. The last six are either novels or longer works. And the first five were all made into movies. I will tell you that. Some of the second half were also made into movies. But definitely the first five were all made into Hollywood films. Number one.
We're taking in individuals who have broken no law. But they surely will, Whitwer affirmed with conviction. Happily they don't, because we get them first before they can commit an act of violence.
Oh, that's the Minority Report.
That's Minority Report, yeah.
Which became the Minority Report.
Number two.
Ed turned, peering into the gray mist. A creature was coming, hurrying rapidly. A man in a white robe. Behind him others came, men in white with equipment. They were lugging complex machinery. Hey, Ed gasped weakly. The men stopped, their mouths open, their eyes popped. Look, something's gone wrong. One still charged. Get the de-energizer. We can't proceed until...
I have no idea. I read a lot of Philip Dick, and I had no idea what this is. It sounds like a lot of other things.
This is the Adjustment Team, which became Adjustment Bureau with Matt Damon. Matt Damon movie.
Yeah.
Number three.
Hendricks lowered his gun. The boy stood silently, looking at him. He was small, not very old. Perhaps 8. But it was hard to tell. Most of the kids who remained were stunted. He wore a faded blue sweater, ragged with dirt, and short pants. His hair was long and matted, brown hair. It hung over his face and around his ears. He held something in his arms. "What's that you have?" Hendrik said sharply. The boy held it out. It was a toy, a bear, a teddy bear. The boy's eyes were large, but without expression.
No clue, man. I'm screwing up the dick jokes today. I'm not getting the dick.
This one is from a story called Second Variety, which became Screamers with Peter Weller.
Okay, there's your answer. I didn't get it. You would have picked 90 other Philip Dick short stories to make into a movie, but you picked that one. Okay, great. So
Peter Weller, who, of course, is Buckaroo Banzai in my heart. Yes.
And he's also top, so there.
Yeah, RoboCop. Four. That's right. Number four.
You'll know you went, all right. You won't remember us, won't remember me, or ever having been here. It'll be a real trip in your mind, we guarantee that. A full 2 weeks of recall, every last piddling detail. Remember this, if at any time you doubt that you really took an extensive trip to Mars, you can return here and get a full refund. You see?
Oh, yeah, this is this became Total Recall twice, and it was from a story called We Can Remember It For You Wholesale.
That's right.
Which is an awesome story. Yeah. The movies are okay, but the story's really good.
Number five.
Jennings scanned the pages. It was his own writing. There was no doubt of it. His hands shook. I can't believe it, even if it is my own writing. He folded up the paper, his jaw set. Something was done to me while I was back there. I never would have agreed to this. You must have had a reason. I admit it doesn't make sense, but you don't know what factors might have persuaded you before your mind was cleaned. You aren't the first. There have been several others before you. Jennings stared down at what he held in his palm. From the cloth sack he had spilled a little assortment of items, a code key, a ticket stub, a parcel receipt, a length of fine wire, half a poker chip broken across, a green strip of cloth, a bus token. This instead of 50,000 credits, he murmured. 2 years.
Oh, Jesus. It sounds like the Minority Report. Not the Minority Report. It sounds like Total Recall.
Mm-hmm.
Same dilemma. You know, this is a distinctly Philip Dick thing. When you wipe the person's personality out, what emerges might be completely different. You might be a totally different person than you thought you were if the context changes. But I don't know what it is.
This is a story called Paycheck, which became a film called Paycheck, starring Ben Affleck and Uma Thurman, directed by John Woo. John Woo is God. Yes. Wow. Okay. All right.
Somehow I missed all of that. So.
Here comes the novels, and the first one is number six.
We take it for granted that you're one of the individuals in Arctur's circle of friends who frequent that house. You were either Jim Barris or Ernie Luckman or Charles Freck or Donna Hawthorne. Donna, he laughed. The suit laughed, actually, in its way. Or Bob Arctur, Hank continued, studying his list of suspects. I report on myself all the time, Fred said.
Yeah, this is awesome. This is a Scanner Darkly,
mm-hmm.
which was made into a rotoscoped cartoon or animation. It wasn't really a cartoon with, believe it or not, Woody Harrelson, Iron Man, Robert Downey Jr.,
yeah.
Keanu Reeves, and Winona Ryder.
Yeah.
And wonderful. They did a really elegant job. They really shot it well. It's one of the few science fiction novels where Atlas Shrugged is mentioned specifically.
Winona Ryder, Spock's mother in the new movie.
I remember one character. It's about drug addiction and so forth. Yeah, but one character ends up in hell, and he is forced to lay there while a multi-eyed beast reads his sins to him forever.
Wow.
So, yeah, he's very imaginative guy, Philip Dick. So.
Number seven.
That made the early secret Christians supra or trans-temporal too, which is to say present at all times, a situation which Fat could not fathom. How could they be early but in the present and the future? And if they existed in the present, why couldn't anyone see them? On the other hand, why couldn't anyone see the walls of the black iron prison which enclosed everyone, including himself, on all sides? Why did these antithetical forces emerge into palpability only when the past, present, and future somehow, for whatever reason, got superimposed?
Oh, that's from one of the Valis books.
That's right. This is from Valis.
Oh, that's yeah.
Now,
got it.
I have something from Paul on this one.
Uh-huh.
Partial credit for not knowing the exact book, but mentioning it is one of the Valis trilogy or something like that.
Okay.
Bonus points to Driftglass.
Hit me. Go ahead.
He can mention anything about what Valis is.
Oh, I can tell you exactly what it is. It's vast, active, living intelligence or intelligent system. Valis.
What is the Black Iron Prison?
The Black Iron Prison is Philip Dick's analogy for Rome, his theory that Rome never fell, that we're still living in the end times.
And what is the significance of Philip K. Dick's revelation/vision/stroke in 1970?
Or drug overdose.
Or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. There was somebody delivering food or drugs or something to his house, and she was wearing a Christian symbol, a fish probably, or a cross. And he swears he was hit in the forehead with a pink laser that basically transmitted to him the entire Valis trilogy, this sort of worldview about that Rome never fell, Jesus just died yesterday, time is an illusion, therefore everything about the Bible is literally true because we're living, you know, it says Jesus won't be back until, you know, in the life of this generation, he'll be back. I believe it says something like that. And his theory is that all time is an illusion, that we live inside this iron prison that's an illusion, and that nothing has really changed. No time has actually passed. We've just been tricked into believing time has passed. And he wrote this long, long exegesis based on his experience. It's this long, hundreds of pages long thingy. And it was the basis for a lot of his books after that.
Wow.
Yeah. And the crap I remember.
Okay, number 8.
Still holding the copy of The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, Robert said, "What sort of alternate present does this book describe?" Betty, after a moment, said, "One in which Germany and Japan lost the war."
Oh, please, please. This is the great one. This is the Man in the High Castle. This is the big one. This is the one everyone remembers. That Philip Dick, I believe, wrote using the I Ching. The Chinese Book of Divination. If I remember correctly, and it's been a few years, when he got to a plot point that required a left turn or a right turn, you know, something to happen one way or the other, he would consult the I Ching and do what it said. So he left it sort of to that book to sort of help him guide him through the plot, if I remember it correctly. But it's a wonderful book. It's one of the first alternate history stories. America losing World War II. Great book. And it's on one of the networks now. I forget which.
Amazon. Yeah, okay. Has it. Okay. So, yeah. All right. Number 9.
The girl handed him a package. "You brought me from the future by what you did there inside the drugstore a few moments ago. You summoned me directly from the factory. Mr. Chip, I could spray it on you if you're too weak to. Shall I? I'm an official factory representative and technical consultant. I know how to apply it."
Oh, I love this one. This is Ubik. This is a wonderful story. It hasn't been made into a movie. It probably should. His stories got more complicated as they went on, but suffice it to say, our characters are not living in the reality they think they're living in.
No spoilers now.
They're being attacked from the outside by a malevolent force. I won't tell you what it is. And the only thing that keeps the force at bay is Ubik. And Ubik appears as consumer products.
Ah.
Spray can, soap, etc. And you'll be watching TV. So don't forget to restock up on Ubik. Ubik prevents blah, 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 blah. And you realize you're in a different iteration of the same hallucination. And you're still stuck in a dream world. And the only way to save yourself is to go get some of this Ubik stuff. And that gives nothing away. It's a wonderful novel. Go pick it up today and read it.
Right. And number 10.
"A final question," he said. "Two-part. You were watching an old movie on TV, a movie from before the war. It shows a banquet in progress. The guests are enjoying raw oysters." "Ugh," Rachel said. The needle swung wildly.
Oh, okay. This is the other big one. This is variously known as Blade Runner, Blade Runner Part 2, Blade Runner the Director's Cut, Blade Runner the final really long Director's Cut, Blade Runner with 12 additional minutes to the Director's Cut, and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sleep? Sheep, rather.
Yeah. Sheep, yes. Ridley Scott just couldn't stop re-releasing that movie.
No. And it was a stunning movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
It really did set the standard in the same way 2001 set a standard for science fiction movies, for realism, and for scope. Blade Runner really did.
And number 11, Paul says this one is tricky, so let's listen to it.
Okay.
Xena said, "The beside helper, upon stopping a person approaching the sifting bridge, asked him if he wished to be represented in the testing which was to come." By the beside helper? The beside helper, she explained, assumed his role of advocate. He offered to speak on the person's behalf. But the beside helper offered something more. He offered to present his own bill of particulars to the retribution mechanism in place of the bill of particulars of the person. If the person were innocent, this would make no difference. But for the guilty, it would yield up a sentence of exculpation rather than guilt. "That's not fair," Emmanuel said. "The guilty should be punished." "Why?" Xena said. "Because it is the law," Emmanuel said. "Then there's no hope for the guilty." Emmanuel said, "They deserve no hope." "What if everyone is guilty?" He had not thought of that.
All right. That was from one of the Valis books. It's either The Divine Invasion or The Transmigration of Timothy Archer. Transmigration.
It's The Divine Invasion.
Yeah.
And Paul writes, "I find this passage to be a really moving one. Dick brought together a whole bunch of concepts from different world religions in this book, and especially in his journal, which amounted to 8,000 pages. Portions of that journal have been published as the book The Exegesis of Philip K. Dick, which is 944 pages long. It is fascinating, but enter at your own risk. Your mind may never be the same."
May I tell you a quick true story?
Is it about Philip K. Dick?
Yes, it is.
Okay, yes, you may.
many long years ago, when I was living in Chicago and alone and sad and hung out with my friends in bars until 2 in the morning shooting pool up on North Clark Street, I had a chance to buy a handwritten copy of Philip K. Dick's Exegesis. I doubt if he hand wrote it, but there was a little consignment shop called Strange Cargo, I believe. And since nothing ever fits me and I don't have to worry about buying clothes, but you'd go in there and you'd check out neckties and shoes and jewelry and stuff, and just a good place to hang out. And there was this bound handwritten copy of his Exegesis, and I didn't buy it because it was like $50, which to me was a lot of money. And it still is. But I never read the Exegesis of Philip K. Dick. It reminds me a little bit of Edgar Allan Poe at the end of his life wrote this thing called Eureka, which was his sort of explosion of ideas about the world. It wasn't meant to be fiction. It was just sort of a whole bunch of ideas written down about stuff. And his guesses, for example, about the nature of the universe were eerily accurate. So some of these artist guys, they get a direct line to something, and they start seeing things that you and I don't see, and they change the world. I mean, Philip Dick's way of seeing fiction changed the genre of science fiction. There's this whole separate subgenre that is really just his, that other people write out of now. But really, he and everybody take a drink now. Robert Heinlein, in a story called, I think, Them, didn't invent, but really kind of perfected the idea that reality is an illusion. And now write about that.
Yeah.
And there's a trick to it. There's a person behind it. There's a force behind it. There's something going on behind the scenes that you're not allowed to see, because if you figure it out, everything falls apart or bad things happen. And Philip Dick really made that genre his own. So, wow, that was great. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, those were really, really good. And we'll be back next week with more Science Fiction University from other folks.
Yay.